Welcome to the Miko Peled Hour. I am your host, Miko Peled. Today I have a special guest, Dr. Hisham Naji, who is a physician here in the area, and he just came back from a medical mission in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip. And there have been a lot of developments over the last 24, 48 hours in and around Palestine, with the attack from Iran and so on. Missiles are coming in from Iran, and there's a lot of distractions. And my objective is to keep the focus where I believe the focus needs to be, which is on just the catastrophic reality in which Palestinians live, and particularly at this point, the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The fact that all these other elements are taking all these other factors are, have become part of the reality has not alleviated the difficulties, have not alleviated the pain, the suffering of the millions of Palestinians who are still suffering, who are still dying from very simple, curable diseases, and so on. So today, Dr. Naji, again, I really appreciate your time and your, of course, your courage in going to Gaza and doing the work that you do. And maybe just first, just give us a little bit of background. What kind of medicine do you practice, and what and so on? Just a little bit of background about yourself.
Yes, thank you. I was actually born in Syria in Damascus. I was raised there. Went to school and then went to medical school there. And when I graduated, I came to the United States to advance my medical training. I went to different states. I ended up in Philadelphia, where I had my anesthesiology training and pediatric anesthesia in the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Then after that, I practiced for more than 20 years in Pennsylvania, and then finally we moved here in 2002 to Northern Virginia.
So you're an anesthesiologist.
I'm an anesthesiologist, yes. I still practice. I cut down on my practice. I do between full time and part time. I do mainly outpatient anesthesia at the present time.
So then you, what happened? You decided to go on this medical mission to Gaza. Talk a little bit about that decision and maybe the first kind of the first preliminary stages, the first preliminary steps of making that decision and getting ready for that trip.
Yeah, I'm a strong believer that, physicians is a unique specialty, unique profession, that it's not only to make money and live comfortably and have a good status in the society, but to help people and save lives. And I have gone on different other medical missions, but when the hostility started in Gaza and the whole world was watching live the atrocities
This
and these
my son Omar here is taking a peek. You just say hi. Hey, brother.
hi.
Please.
So I, as everybody else, we were watching the atrocity and the suffering of the Palestinian people and the continuous bombing. The trigger in me that if I can help, if I can be there to save life, I would do that. And actually, the one video that I saw, and many people saw that, a local Palestinian physician in Gaza, when his building was bombed, lost some member of his family, and one of his own daughter was a small teenager. Her leg was crushed, and he had to do amputation on his own daughter without any anesthesia at all, in the on the kitchen table, basically. And that was a horrible picture, and you cannot imagine seeing that in real life. And so I said, I wanted to go and help, and I put my name with different medical relief organizations that do medical missions, especially to Gaza. And then they called me from the Palestinian American Medical Association, so the organization I went with. They say, if you're still interested, we like to have you. We need an anesthesiologist. And I said, yes.
So
Of course, you know.
let me interrupt you just for just a
Yes,
second,
yes.
if I may. So you saw the horrors taking place, the just the constant bombing, the enormous amounts of casualties. You surely you realize you're taking an enormous risk to go to Gaza at this particular point, and yet you're willing, not only willing, but you had the assumption that you would be able to go in and help somehow. Talk about that a little bit, because I mean, I can't imagine. I think most people cannot imagine seeing the horrors taking place in Gaza and then thinking, well, I want to go there into that, this hellfire that is, being thrown in Gaza and helping out. So talk about that process a little bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah, it wasn't really an easy decision. You know, like I say, initially you're taken by the emotion, and when you sign your name, and but then when they call me and they said, "We need you, you know, are you still willing to go?" Of course, you know, the anxiety from within me started, like you say, you know, this is not like other medical missions I've done in the past. This
And
is
it's not even over. In other words, if you go, let's say there's a disaster or a disaster area, an earthquake, I mean, it's some of the other horrible things that happen, the medical mission usually go in after it's over. You went in when it is conti when it's still going on, when things are still going on. I mean, this is severe. This is
Yeah.
a decision that is an incredible decision. So, I like to pause a little bit because I think it's important for listeners to come to terms and to let it sink in, just the enormity and the weight of that decision.
It is true, yes, like you said, you know, other medical missions like earthquake. I went actually the year before to the northern Syria and Turkey for the earthquake medical relief, but this is different. And and the violence in Gaza wasn't actually decreasing, was even getting worse and worse every day. And you know, I have to struggle within myself. You know, I made a decision, I volunteer, and now they need me. I'm gonna have to go and take all the chances. And of course, you know, I have some, you know, my religious belief that when my time comes, it's gonna come, whether I'm in a war zone or in my comfort zone. But my family, all of them, my wife and kids, even grandkids and friends, they were opposing this, and they said, "No, you cannot go there. You know, you can get killed." And I told them that, you know, that you know, when my time comes, it's gonna come, and I would rather go when I'm helping other people and saving lives, and my life is not more important and more valuable than those people who are dying every day there.
Yeah.
So they.
Then you were contacted. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So the you know the, we kept struggling this with my family until the last day, even at the airport, you know, when I left, and it was very emotional, knowing inside me that I may not come back, but the other side of me kept saying, "No, you have to go. You know, it's very important to help and make a difference there, and taking all the risk." So I did.
So then you contacted, or you were called back by the Palestinian American Medical Association to join
Yes.
their mission. What were your expectations? What did you think you were going to do? I mean, what happened from that point on?
Yeah, initially we did wasn't very sure where we're gonna go, which hospitals. There were some very hot areas. Initially, they say the Nasser Hospital or Shuhada al-Quds hospitals and or European hospitals, but then few days or 2 days before we left, they told us the other two hospitals are very risky, so we're gonna go to the European hospital. And we submitted, you know, our medical license, our copy of the passport, and other papers, and they had to submit it to the World Health Organizations, who was coordinating these medical missions with, I'm sure, the US government, the Egyptian government, and the Israeli government, so that we were allowed to make that trip and go through.
And
So
then I'm
we.
assuming you flew into Cairo and you took that long journey from Cairo.
And we flew from here to stopped in Istanbul and then Cairo. We spent a whole day in Cairo, meeting with the United Nations representatives and the World Health Organization representatives. They briefed us on our medical missions, what to expect, where to go, and the two lines that stuck in our head. They told us, you don't leave the hospital, stay there for the 2 weeks you're there, because it's much higher risk when you leave the hospital campus. And the second thing they said, we don't guarantee your life. It's a very high risk area. So you have to understand that you are making that decision on your own, and your life is on the line. So it was,
Did anybody decide to turn back after they heard this?
no one actually.
How many people were in the mission in their delegation?
My group, we were only five. It was me and two other surgeons. One of them is a trauma surgeon from Pittsburgh, and the other one is the head of the maxillary facial surgery program in Kansas City University. And then we had oncologist from California and a trauma nurse from Tampa, Florida.
I see. So then you took off from Cairo on the long journey, I'm assuming.
Like I said, we the they told us to meet in the morning. There's a building belonging to the World Health Organization there, all the cars, and then we found out there was other group. There were like 10 or 11 other groups, some of them like food distributions and other humanitarian group, and some other physicians from different organizations. So we left in the morning, and the funny thing is that they aligned us in a line. Each group, they give us a number to our car. We were in like a van. It's bigger than minivans. And say, each group, remember your number. You're number three, you're number seven. And when you drive from here to Gaza, you stay in the same sequence. Don't change. So basically, they didn't say it clearly, but they hinted, they're drawn in the sky watching you.
So you have to keep the same order of the vans
Same
as
order,
passengers and
exactly. And don't leave the car unless he said that after you pass the Suez Canal and crossing the Sinai Desert, the whole trip's supposed to be from Cairo to Gaza less than 6 hours. But it took like 15 hours. They told us there will be eight
15
checkpoints.
hours?
It was 15 hours, yes.
You must have been delayed quite a bit on the way.
Yes, like there were eight military checkpoints, Egyptian, along the Sinai. Every time you drive like 50 miles or some distance, you stop, and then you stop for half an hour, you stop for an hour, until they say, okay, now we're going to let you go. It was very tiring, very annoying that you get to the checkpoint, they say, okay, pull to the side of the road to turn your car off and just wait. But we had a bigger goal in our head, in our mind, so we didn't mind that. And they told us, the World Health Organization, they say you have to be in a state of mind, that accept everything. Don't argue, and don't be hostile to anybody.
15 hours you arrived. So just for the listeners, so that you know the geography, so you've go through from Cairo, to the Suez Canal, then you cross the Suez Canal, and then you drive through the northern part of the Sinai Sinai Peninsula, Sinai Desert, until you get to the border point with Palestine, which is Rafah.
Yes.
And that's the border crossing. And then did you have to, and then you cross, what time did you arrive in Gaza then, when you were
Well,
already
we
in the
arrived about
Palestine?
9 o'clock. We the convoy of cars started at 6 in the morning, and then we arrived there at 9 o'clock in the evening. Well, the funny things, it wasn't really funny at the time, that when we reached the last checkpoint, the Egyptian one, basically the immigration building of the Egyptian. Once you pass that line, you're in no man's zone for maybe a quarter of a mile, and then you reach the building, the Palestinian building. And then once you reach there, you're in Palestine, you're in Rafah, basically. So at the
Yeah.
Egyptian side, they told us, now it's getting very late, and Israel enforce a curfew after 6 p.m. And they don't want any cars driving on the road after 6 p.m. And we
So they
said,
won't turn
okay,
you back, won't turn
that's
you
the
back.
option. They said, well, you go to a small town in Egypt, there's some hotel there. I think
Arish,
Al
yeah.
Arish, it's called Al
Yes.
Arish,
Yeah.
very close to Rafah. You stay there, and then next morning you continue your journey. We were really upset, like us and some other, the other cars decided to do that. So they turn around and they went to Arish and they checked in a hotel and spent the night there. Next morning they came. We decided, our team leader say, no, we don't want to cut our service one day. We came here to help people. We're gonna go, and hopefully they're gonna recognize this is a medical mission car, and most likely we're gonna be okay. We're gonna take chances. So what do
So you are when I heard you speak a couple of weeks ago at the Palestinian American Medical Association event, you said something about the moment that you entered into Palestine. So you finally crossed the no man's zone and you entered into Palestine, into Rafah, which is the Palestinian side, and you saw the sign, "Welcome to Palestine."
Yeah,
Can you
it
talk
was
about
really emotional
that?
moment for me, because I haven't been in Palestine at all, and this is beside the medical mission. Part of my family was actually from Haifa, from Palestine, and I remember when I was a little boy, my aunt and her husband and their kids were staying in our house. We were talking about the early 50s, and so I learned as a young boy that my aunt and her husband and her family, they owned a bakery in Haifa, and when in 1948 during the Nakba were forced to leave, and they came to live with us, and then later on they moved on to their house. So that emotional feeling, the attachment to Palestine, and all what's been going on for 75 years. And when I reached that moment and I saw the sign, "Welcome to Palestine" in Arabic, it was really emotional. And I told the car, "Please stop. I want to take a picture of this." And it was, like.
So I just want to remind the listeners, if you're just joining us, this is the Mikko Pellet Hour. I'm Mikko Pellet, and I'm speaking to Dr. Hisham Naji, an anesthesiologist who has come back recently from a medical mission, a very dangerous medical mission, I should add, to the Gaza Strip. And so that connection to Palestine, you had, so not only was there a strong connection to Palestine anyway, but now you're entering a very difficult time in the history of Palestine, and you're putting your life on the line in order to help people in Palestine at this very, very difficult moment. So I can't, I just, again, I like to slow down and let this sink in so listeners can appreciate what it is that we're talking about in terms of the commitment to Palestine, the commitment to, as a physician and putting yourself in that very difficult and emotionally very taxing reality. So then you entered and it was late at night already. So where did you go?
Yes, we entered the building. We put our suitcases for to be checked in and passport. It didn't take too long. They were very nice to us. They appreciate us coming. And the funny thing, I was expecting to see like military personnel there with weapons and stuff. This is border, and like we saw in the Egyptian checkpoints. There wasn't any. There were only civilians, employee, who greeted us and took the passport, and they told us to sit, their waiting room. We waited for approximately half an hour until they finish all the check-in, and then they told us you're good to go now.
And what did you do?
So we exited that building from the other side of that building, and there were some cars like taxis, so we and we had a lot of luggage with us. Each one of us was carrying three or four suitcases filled with medical supplies, and also we had like many boxes of bottled water. We bought it in Cairo. That should be enough for us for the 2 weeks we're staying, because they told us, we cannot guarantee any thing as far as food supply, as far as water supply, so take with you everything you need. So we had to take like three cars, three or four, I can remember, to put all our suitcases, all our stuff, and drive to the hospital.
Which hospital did you end up going to?
The European hospital.
And
In
that was.
Khan Yunis.
So now you arrive and it's probably close to 11 o'clock at night, right?
No, actually, like I said, we got to the checkpoint, the Palestinian checkpoint, about 9 o'clock. It didn't take from there to the hospital, it didn't take more than 20 minutes.
And then what? You walked into the hospital.
So we were there and we waited until the officers or the people in charge of the hospital where we're going to stay. And this is another thing they told us, we cannot guarantee that we will have a place for you to stay in the building. We may put a tent for you outside the building, so bring your sleeping bag, your pillows and everything. But they told us, okay, we have a room here in the chronic patient area that sometime we put nurses or doctors when they come in. Was a small room. They have like a six small military bed, like cot, and so we stayed there, and we have our own bathroom there. So we were kind of very lucky to have that compared to the situation outside the building.
So
And
you said you had to take food and water to last you 2 weeks. You had to
yes.
take you brought with you medical supplies, a lot of medical supplies, each and every one of you. And I want to stress that any place throughout the Gaza Strip, within a stone's throw, there are hospitals, fully equipped, medical facilities, food, clean water, everything and anything anybody could possibly need within a short drive from any point in Gaza into out of the fence, on the other side of the fence, on the side the Palestinians are prohibited. So the fact that there's all this need to bring all this stuff is really absolutely absurd because it's all right there, a very short drive out of the Gaza Strip. So this absurd reality is imposed on millions of people in the Gaza Strip and was imposed on you, even as a medical mission, even though realistically, geographically, in any way, shape, or form, it makes absolutely no sense because there's such an abundance of everything, a very short drive on the other side of the fence on the Israeli side. So I just like to emphasize that so listeners have an idea We're not talking about some secluded place far, far away from civilization where there's no access to water or food or medicine. It's an enclave that is isolated, and people are prevented from accessing, all the things that they need. So
Yeah,
then,
you're exactly right. I mean, it was really inhumane to treat them like this. And as you know, and the listeners, Gaza has been in a total siege for more than 17 years. And then since October 7, that siege became like so tight, is strangulating totally, like water supply, medical supplies, food supply. And the sad things, and I need to mention to the listeners, the last probably 25 miles in our trip in the northern desert before we got to the border entering Rafah, Gaza, on both sides of the highway were thousands and thousands of trucks, big trucks and small trucks, full of humanitarian aid.
thousands of trucks.
Thousands of truck and I was I couldn't I mean I was taping had my camera and I was video for so many minutes as we're driving and those lines of trucks never end until we got to the actual border of Rafah. They were not allowed to get in and we were told that only like every few days Israel will allow a very small number of trucks to get in, which is not enough for anything really. And it is sad when we got inside Gaza and we saw the need and the shortage and all that supply the countries organization donated, they're sitting on the other side of the border, we're not allowed to get in.
So not only do people in within the Gaza Strip have access to the medical facilities and supplies and the food and the water that's just a few kilometers away on the other side of the fence, but the Israeli authority, because of the Israelis, are preventing them from accessing this. But they're also preventing supplies from coming into the Gaza Strip, supplies that are being donated on a regular basis from people all over the world that want to donate and help the people in Gaza. So there's tons and tons and tons of supplies, food and medical supplies and water, presumably, that is prevented by Israel from entering. So if they're not allowing people to access resources and they're preventing resources from coming in, and at the same time, they're bombing and killing people. If we look at the definition, or if we look for a definition that describes in a word what this is, and it's a crime, the word that comes up is genocide. This is taking people and preventing them from food, medicine, and water. So this is an intention to kill. There's no other way to describe denying people these kinds of resources other
Yeah,
than
you're right. You're
killing
right.
them.
I mean, it is all of us, and not only us from Arabic origins. We had some other people from England, from Norway, from France, and everybody was sharing the same idea. My gosh, this is genocide. This is eradicating an entire people. They want them to be dead. And the Palestinian there that we met in the hospitals, the doctors, the nurses, the technicians, and I had some, frequent conversations with them, and they tell us, we are doomed to die here. We are like somebody in a prison who with the death sentence, but we don't know when the bomb's gonna come to kill us.
We have to take a look. We have to take a break. So, if you're just joining us, this is the Micro Pellet Hour. My guest is Dr. Hisham Naji. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Micro Pellet Hour. I'm your host, Micro Pellet, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Hisham Naji, who has just recently returned from a medical mission, and like I said earlier, an extremely dangerous medical mission to the Gaza Strip. Describing the horrors, not only describing, but having come out, having been willing to enter the horrors as they are continuing. As we know, there has not been a cease, any break in the killing and the bombing. the starvation, the disease, and so on. So he entered all of that in an attempt to help. Thankfully, came back out safely and is able to tell us about it. So we describe the journey, we describe, the reality. Talk a little bit about what you saw as a physician, and I'll give you a prompt, if I may. When you gave the talk a couple of weeks ago, there were two things that you said that really stuck in my mind. One was, and I've heard other physicians say that the injuries, the wounds that you saw were like nothing you've ever seen before. And the second one was that oftentimes after having treated these wounds, the patients would come back because they weren't healing. And so these are things that that puzzled you, if I understand correctly. So can you talk a little bit about what you saw, what you did in terms of, as a physician, as a doctor?
From the first day, like the morning after we arrived there, we went to the hospitals, and they have like six operating rooms, and they were all full and they were all busy and doing patient after patient. There was nonstop flow of injuries, patient coming in, and like you say, the injury we saw really like horrible. I've never seen like this before, multiple amputations, shrapnels that go into the body, doesn't cause a clean cut. It destroyed the skin, the muscles, the tendons, the bone, and those patients, they keep coming back for debridement. Debridement means removing the dead tissue until you get to the fresh, supposedly health tissue. But those patients, they keep coming back again and again and again. We became like familiar with some patients who keep coming like frequent, patients to the operating room for debridement. And the local doctors, they told us, those shrapnels, and I had one in my hand, one of those shrapnels. It's very ugly looking. They told us they really have a strong belief that those shrapnels was coated with some kind of chemical so the wounds won't heal. And of course, they don't have sophisticated lab to analyze or to prove it scientifically, but they all have that belief from what they saw and what we saw also.
So again, I think it's important to let people let this sink in. So you the type of injuries and then the lack of healing led the local doctors to think that the bombs that exploded and therefore the shrapnel, the pieces of shrapnel that you found inside people's bodies were somehow coated with something. And that's why the normal healing process that you'd expect wasn't taking place. Is that what I'm understanding? Am I understanding correctly?
That's right. Now, of course, there are other elements, the malnutrition and the probably the lack of the proper antibiotics may also added to that misery of those patients, because we worked under very strained situation there. We had to use whatever available of equipment, whatever available of medications. Like even in my specialty, normally we change all the disposable tubes between patients. Over there, we use the same tubing, the same anesthesia circuits from patient to patient, which means a high possibility of transmitting infections from one patient to another. But they have no choice, We had to save the life, and then we'll later on we think about, the infection. They don't have enough supply.
Now, you're an anesthesiologist, and one of the things we hear very often is that there is no, that a lot of the surgery that's taking place is taking place without anesthesia because of the lack because of the lack of medicine, because of the lack of ability to do that. So how did that work out? Were you practicing as an anesthesiologist, or were you doing other forms of medicine?
I practiced mostly as an anesthesiologist. I mean, that hospital was luckier than other places they do have the very basic supply of medications and anesthetic gases to anesthetize patient. But we also brought with us another group brought with them. I mean, the hallway of the hospital was full of boxes from people like us brought with them some supply. So we really didn't get to the point where we performed surgery without anesthesia. Thank God. I mean, we brought with us a whole suitcase full of local anesthesia, and like I say, they still have some kind of supply to manage anesthetizing patient going under surgery. But other places in Gaza, we heard from eyewitness, you know, they had to do some kind of minor surgery without local anesthesia because they ran out of it.
Now, talk a little bit more about just the, I mean, you're obviously when you're working in a ER or an operating room, sorry, an OR in the United States, there's certain procedures you take for granted. There's certain protocols that you take for granted, equipment and so forth that you take for granted. What did you find? How did you, what did, first of all, what did you find that was different, that was lacking? And then how did you bridge that? How did you compensate?
For example, you know, the monitoring, you know, here in not only United States, everywhere in the world, you know, in the operating room, there is a monitor that monitors the blood pressure, the heart rhythm, the pulse oximeter, the end-tidal CO2. This is the carbon dioxide coming out of the patients. Those are the basic monitoring. And most of these monitors, they needed some parts, which they don't have. And none of those carbon dioxide analysis element was functioning because they told us we don't have part to replace it. And the EKG, which is the heart rhythm, many of those monitors were that part was not working. And the main thing was the pulse oximeter. Even that in one of the monitor was not working properly. So we brought with us some portable. And many of the doctors who came on medical mission, they brought with them the small portable pulse oximeter that give the anesthesiologist the information of how the patient is well oxygenated. And that's one of the most important part of giving anesthesia safely to patients. So we have to work around those equipment and to accept the minimum monitor, which is only the pulse oximeter. In some cases, to make sure that the patient was well oxygenated, we can see the rhythm from the pulse, and do the cases. You cannot request, you know, you don't have, we don't have the luxury to say, you know, bring me another monitor. You know, I need. They don't have it. And the same thing for the inhalation anesthetic agent. Was one that I have not used here in the state for a long time, isoflurane. There's some much better anesthetic agent, but we had to use it, and we did all the cases with it, and we managed. Again, painkiller. They didn't have strong painkiller. For example, you know, fentanyl that we use, one of the main analgesic that we use in the operating room. They didn't have it, so we had to use some other less potent analgesic for pain control. And the same thing, the surgeons, you know, I've seen surgeon, like the doctor who was with me, his maxillofacial surgeons, he was helping orthopedic surgeon doing amputations and helping general surgeons doing abdominal exploration. So everyone was, you know, I was doing some dressing changes to patients. Whatever they need us, you know, we told it that the local doctor there, we're here to help. You tell us what you need us to do, we'll do it.
And what about the discharge? In other words, once you send somebody, where do you send them to? How do they care for their wounds? I mean, what are they supposed to do? What
Yeah,
happened?
they're like once the patient surgery finished, we take the patient to the recovery room. Now, normally in a recovery room, there's like one nurse to a patient or one nurse to two patients. That recovery room, it was big enough for maybe six patients, but sometimes we have 10 or 12, and there's only one nurse. So we try to help staying with our patient until we make sure that the breathing okay, or it's safe for me to leave the patient, because I know once I leave there, probably that nurse is not going to have time to check that patient. So it's it wasn't the ideal situation for us to practice, but we understand that, and we the situation there and the shortage of personnel, the shortage of equipment, we had to accept it and deal with it from patient to patient.
How long did they stay in the rec I mean, how long did they stay in the recovery room before they were sent? And where were they?
Yeah.
Where were
Yeah,
they sent?
some of them, they don't stay as we like to. Usually we like the patient to be fully awake, alert, everything's stable before we ship the patient from the recovery room to their to the floor to where they stay, because over there nobody's going to watch them, only maybe a member of their family. They have severe shortage of nurses. I was told the emergency room, there's only one doctor, one ER doctor there, and sometimes there is 20 or 30 people laying on the floor.